Welcome, everyone. I think we've been charged with welcoming everybody to this joint convening of the patient engagement and addressing disparities panel. I think the first thing that I wanted to do is make sure that we introduce each other. I'm Darius Tandon. I'm the co-chair of the Patient Engagement Advisory Panel.
I'm Charlotte Collins, chair of the Patient Engagement Advisory Panel.
Dorian Miller, co-chair of the Advisory Panel on Addressing Disparities.
And I'm Grant Jones, and I'm the co-chair with Dorian of the Addressing Disparities Panel.
Good afternoon. My name is Ramona Hossein-Bunia, and I direct the Addressing Disparities program at Macquarie.
And I'm Sue Sheridan. I'm the Director of Patient Engagement.
So we'd also like to have everyone to introduce themselves, and we can talk a little bit about why we wanted to have the opportunity to meet jointly. So maybe if we could start at the far end of the room on this side, and Alan, if you would start, please.
I'm Alan Morris. I'm the President and CEO of Lighthouse Guild.
Patrick Kitzman, University of Kentucky, also Director of the Kentucky Appalachian Rural Rehabilitation Network.
Healthy Breland Noble, Department of Psychiatry, Georgetown University Medical Center.
Steve Lynn, Director of Patient Reported Outcomes at Glaxo Smith Kline.
Melanie Nix, Breast Cancer Conference Site.
Carmen Reyes, UCLA Department of Medicine.
Julie Moretz, and I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Patient and Family Centered Care at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, but I'm a family leader.
Gail Hunt, I'm the head of the National Alliance for Caregiving, and I'm also on the board of Macquarie.
Jean Fusky, I'm the Chief Engagement and Dissemination Officer at Macquarie.
Martin Gordon with the U.S. Department of Treasury and General Revenue Service and in time with the Affordable Care Act Office.
I'm Kristen Carmen. I'm a Vice President in the Human Social Development Program. Health and Social. I was talking about my graduate school experience earlier. Health and Social Development Program at the American Institute for Research.
And I'm Mark Booten with the National Health Council and a patient advocate.
And my name is Venus Junez. I am the CEO and founder of Dia de la Mujer Latina, the largest breast and cervical cancer in the country, and also the instructor at Baylor College of Medicine.
Tammy Burns at Creighton University School of Medicine.
Pastor Bruce Hansen, 45-year patient caregiver and board member of the Great River Patient Engagement Cluster and new appointee to the American Board of Internal Medicine.
Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Vice Chair of Research at the University of Nevada School of Medicine.
Monique Carter, a research scientist for Arose Pharmaceuticals and also a patient advocate.
Lena Wen, I'm a physician and researcher at George Washington University.
Marianne Sander, Vice President for Asia and Disability Services at University of Pittsburgh Medical Center.
Steve Arcon,
Novartis
Pharmaceuticals.
Chin Chi Huang, I'm the founder of Asian Breast Cancer Project and the Executive Director of Asian Women for Health.
Paul Arthur, occupational therapist, University of Florida.
Martina Gallagher, assistant professor at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston.
Laurel Pratt. I'm a patient advocate with the MRG Oncology and I'm with the Ovarian Cancer Alliance, National Alliance.
I am Deborah Stewart. I'm Medical Director of Client and Provider Solutions at Florida Blue.
Hi, Amy Gibson, COO with the Patient Center Primary Care Collaborative.
Liz Jacobs, I'm a Primary Care Doctor and Associate Vice Chair for Health Services Research at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health.
Corrine Johnson, I'm the Executive Director of LymeDisease.org. I'm the co-chair of the steering committee of Q, Consumers United for Evidence-Based Healthcare, which is a coalition of 40 national groups, and I'm on the executive committee of P-Cornet.
Russell Rothman. I direct the Center for Health Services Research at Vanderbilt, and I'm on the executive committee of BCORNET.
A few members to join us. One of our team members, Jackie, would you
introduce yourself? Hi, I'm Jackie Grant. I'm a public health director for the Southwest Georgia Public Health District in Albany, Georgia.
Sarah Vangertrid with the Partnership to Improve Patient Care.
I'm Harry Cohen. I'm an 18-year Parkinson's patient advocate. I founded the Parkinson's Pipeline Project.
And I'm Anya Kellen. I'm a program associate with the patient engagement team at POI.
Kevin Casella, I'm a family physician researcher at the University of Rochester.
Alina Chen, I'm also a primary care physician and a health services researcher working on how we pay taxes.
I think that's everyone that's around the horseshoe. Thank you. We wanted to come together with the patient engagement advisory panel to learn a little bit more about the work that you're doing, and particularly in the development of principles and guidelines for the work that takes place, and to look at opportunities, if there are any opportunities for crossover. This has been an ongoing theme in the discussions that the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel has had in their briefing reviews to say, this really fits in with X, this really fits in with Y. Shouldn't we take the time to learn a little bit more about the work that's coming out of other advisory panels to both inform the discussions that we're having amongst ourselves, but also to look for opportunities for crosswalk? And so leadership through PCOR has graciously agreed to facilitate the conversation for this afternoon and to allow us to do so. And so I believe that we've got a couple of discussions and presentations that are going to be taking place. Is that right? And the first one is going to be about the ambassadors program that's taking place through PCOR. And so, Sue, are you going to tee that up?
I'm going to give the presentation. But just a little genesis about the ambassador program. And many of you may have been present at the first patient engagement workshop that McCory did in October 2012 during Hurricane Sandy. Bringing patients together to help us create us in terms of patient-centeredness and patient engagement. And at the conclusion of the meeting, a patient stood up and said, Corey, you have an ambassador in the room. And really encouraged us to think about how do we really leverage the enthusiasm, the motivation of those already kind of in the PCORI family to help create awareness about PCORI, and also for those who are interested in becoming engaged in the research. It really follows our strategic plan of creating community, engaging that community in research, and then disseminating our findings. And so within PCORI, we brainstormed about how can we do this, and Anya did some research and looked at other similar type of programs nationally and I think even internationally, and we launched the ambassador program that Anya can talk about, and then we can answer some questions and share how there's been a lot of cross-fertilization between ambassadors and PCORNET and pipelines and other programs that are having these advisory panels. So it's an exciting program that's just taking off, and we welcome your comments and questions.
Okay. Thanks for that, Sue. So I'll dive right in. So today my goal is to provide you all with an update on the status of our program. And to one of our upcoming events is our first annual meeting, so I wanted to have an opportunity to just share some information about that and receive some input. And also our evaluation plan. So our patient engagement advisory panel, this is definitely one of their babies. They have been with me throughout the entire revolution of the program, so I'm very thankful for that. But again, you know, any feedback from the Addressing Disparities team is greatly welcome, your panel. So as of right now, we have a total of 81 ambassadors. And the way it is, we have two ways that you could become an ambassador. You can either be an individual or you can be a liaison for an organization of your choice. And so as of right now, we have 67 individuals who have completed their form, their conflict of interest, and are enrolled in our training program as an individual. And then another 14, we've received letters of support from their organization, and they're also enrolled to participate in the training. And so currently, the program is open to individuals who have already been involved with PCORI in some way. So we have quite a bit of merit reviewers. We have advisory panelists, and I hope that everyone from the Addressing Disparities panel will join us. Our PEEP are our inaugural ambassadors, so since they birthed it. But we would hope that we have more individuals apply and take part in the training. So when we completed these slides last week, we had 24 individuals who finished the training. But this morning I checked, and we currently have 36. So we sent out a reminder last week so that really, you know, put the fire under some individuals to help get us our numbers up for training. And the training is really something that we're proud of. It's 5 modules, you know, discussing your role as an ambassador. We have a section dedicated to our methodology, section at PCORI. So we hope that you all, you know, take advantage of the training. And then we also are proud to say that we've launched our first quarterly newsletter back in March, and some of the ambassadors or patient engagement members sitting around the table were highlighted from some of the work that they're doing out in their communities. The next newsletter will go out in June. So our annual meeting is taking place in June, and we're pairing it with our regional event. So it's going to be in Minneapolis, and we've confirmed the dates for June 18th and 19th. So some of you may have received a save the date for that. And so we're still working out the details for the agenda, but we definitely want to highlight some more of the activities that ambassadors are doing. Just to really give a flavor for how you can exactly, you know, use your training and all the toolkit materials that we provide to your advantage. And we are planning to host some sort of social media training because we've seen that that would be valuable to some ambassadors. And to also highlight the different opportunities. We feel that many of our ambassadors would be great candidates for our Pipeline to Proposal Awards. So we hope to, you know, spread more information about that and on how that's opening up to other areas nationally. And we held our first planning meeting last week. We did a call for volunteers from our ambassadors community, and 3 individuals, you know, helped in, you know, shaping the agenda from the objectives that we want to hold. And so we're inputting all of that feedback, and we'll send out a final agenda to everyone who's an ambassador. And so we've always, you know, definitely PCORI is a learning organization, and we want to learn from all of our programs. And so we've really put a lot of work into developing an evaluation of the program, because eventually we want to open it up to the public. And so the feedback that we receive from our many tools of evaluation will help us do that in a really thoughtful way that would be helpful to everyone who's interested in PCORI. And so our 6-month evaluation, there will be a little delay in that. We had originally planned for that to be done in March, but due to a couple of hiccups with the training, we just want to give some time for individuals to get trained, and then we'll evaluate it at that point. So we'll have that out in August. But some of the key questions that we really want to get into, we want to learn more about individuals who are interested in becoming ambassadors. Why exactly are you interested? What communities are you coming from? Where geographically are you located? And also just, you know, their understanding of PCORI and the work that we do at PCORI and all of our efforts. Also, our training, we, you know, it's 5 modules. It's a time commitment, and we appreciate everyone taking part of it, but we want to learn, you know, did we, you know, miss the mark, or how can we improve? Was it useful? And so most of the feedback that we received from our 35 ambassadors who've taken part of it, it's been very positive, but we would, you know, really love to hear additional feedback on that. And lastly, you know,
at the end, we want to know how our ambassadors are engaging others in their Peace Corps efforts, really bringing others in to learn more about how we're doing this research differently. And so we're really hopeful that all the information obtained will lead us to opening up the trainings and programs to the public. And so it was really a quick and dirty intro. I really wanted to have, an opportunity to have some questions or feedback.
I'd just like to add to what Anya shared, and thank you, Anya, something in our ambassador composition that it was somewhat surprising. We were delighted that when we formed this, it was us thinking mostly about patient organizations. However, from those numbers that Anya just shared, we have several clinicians. We have nursing organizations, we have physician organizations, we have researchers who have all shared that they want to be part of communicating the promise of Peace Corps. And also the enthusiasm of part of this ambassador program is when you complete the training that we agree to post your name or organization on our ambassador website online as potential patient or stakeholder partners. So researchers will we hope, seek out ambassadors gone through the training for patient partners in research proposals. So we think that's kind of, a matchmaking in essence. Another thing that our ambassador program is doing is allowing ambassadors to form affinity groups or areas of interest such as rural health or oncology or mental health or certain areas where together they might be able to help promote a research question, or we may do a convening together. And you may ask, what are the advantages of being an ambassador? Well, a lot of people were very happy that people want to share with their communities the opportunities that PCORI has for them to get involved in research. Also, we have invited some of you sitting around the table we have ambassadors that have done presentations with or on behalf of PCORI. They have authored things. Julie Morris did a presentation at her hospital. We've had bloggers, and so we really hope to partner with ambassadors going forward in convenings and in authoring and doing blogs and articles. And so I think it'll be a nice way to promote the word about PCORI and how we are different and demonstrate those partnerships. So I just wanted to give you a little extra information about the ambassadors, and I'll give the microphone back to Anya, and she can lead the questions and answers.
Hi, Gail. I'm curious that you've, Susanna has kind of given us a little bit more information about the what, and you talked about the training, but what are the ambassadors, are they supposed to have an ask for the community, not in terms of money, but in terms of what are they asking these people to do that they're going out and speaking to, and what's the purpose of it, really?
Yeah, thank you for that, Gail. So, the purpose would be for them to spread the word of Peace Corps and to get more individuals involved in the types of work. So, I mean, it would be different for the different stakeholder group. So we have many clinicians and researchers who are interested, and they do presentations to get individuals to embrace our way of research into different research projects that they're involved in. For patients, we have patient groups who are just saying, hey, are you interested in being part of an executive committee? So I think the more specific ask is to have individuals embrace our way of research.
To continue the theme from our meeting this morning, do we have a sense of the racial, gender, ethnic, geographic breakdown? Well, geographic you showed us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. So we are currently open only to individuals who have already been involved with PCORI, so we're a little limited in that way right now. But I can definitely share a more better breakdown of what we have here on the slide, but we can use a lot more diversity in African-American and Hispanic communities, definitely out in the West and in the Midwest. But I think that once the program is open to the public and with our regional events that we're doing, The fact that the training is available, I know that a lot of ambassadors were anticipating that and really looking forward to their certificate. So I'm confident that we'll meet our goals in having more diversity in the program. Hello.
Alfie Greeland Noble. Can you just share a little bit about what you think some of the longer-term impacts of the Foreign Ambassadors Program might be, what your hopes are?
Yeah, so thank you for that. So we see that, you know, PCORE will be a household, you know, subject to talk about. And so we'll have different affinity groups paired together nationwide on various disease issues or, you know, health issues that relate to a certain community. We have quite a bit of individuals who are ambassadors who are interested in issues involving elderly care. So we see that all of our stakeholder buckets, we have about 8 at PCORE, that will have representations of ambassadors in all of those, and they're, you know, building community and spreading the word to help us disseminate information.
Some ways it feels like there's a sustainability aspect to it, that even long after the initial function of the ambassador, that part of what they're going to do is spread this idea that this particular approach to doing research is something that people really should consider, dare I say, outside the context of the PCORE, just in general.
Absolutely, and the training. You know, let's not forget that. I mean, it's 5 modules, close to 3 hours worth of training, and so it really goes into depth of methodology for PCORE. And so there, we feel that, especially for patients, advocates, and you know, really engaged individuals in their care, that's a set group of people that researchers and clinicians can tap into and say, hey, you were trained, and are you interested in partnering with me? Or, you know, all of our patient and advocacy groups, they're empowered by that, and that they can reach out to clinicians in their community to be involved.
I'd like to just answer your question about sustainability and long-term, well, more of the long-term vision is that we feel that if we engage our ambassadors up front, we plan on really tapping into the ambassadors for a right, so we can learn from the ambassadors as well. So we want this kind of two-way relationship. But long-term, we see them also as a really important dissemination pathway. And so when, right now, we don't have research yet, the findings disseminate, but as we create this community and engage them all along the way through a variety of different convenings and other opportunities, we're hopeful that there'll be that dissemination pathway, one of our dissemination pathways, into their communities.
Dorian Miller, is Regina at the end of the table here? Because I can't quite see around the corner. Thanks, Regina. I was wondering, Regina, if you could provide a little bit of context for people who are in the room around the PCORE Ambassador Program that you're doing with pastors in the South Suburban area of Chicago and the event that I had the opportunity to attend in early March.
Yes, I will. Thank you, Dorian. Good afternoon, everybody, and I apologize for being a little late. Since June of 2013, since, you know, I'm a member of the Patient Engagement Advisory Panel, and I thought I consider it very important that we really, really bring PCORE into the community and activate the community to engage in research, especially those communities who have not had the opportunity to be engaged before. You know, I'm focusing on African American, Latino. Pastor Bruce and I are partnering on rural healthcare, and all of those who have been outside of really the research conversations. So we've had a path, and we've created a research ministry in churches. We've the Southland Ministerial Health Network, we've been around for about 6 years. I've been involved with them in projects. We convened a program called Pastors for PCORE, so that we can actually be involved, learn about research. They've been involved with research before and with Place Matters, if any of you are familiar with that. But really understand how research will benefit us and how we can get at the table to be part of the research program and really design it. So we started research ministries, we've got a governing board, and we've actually started patient engagement clusters where we're really having conversations and learning about research and healthcare and get rid of some of the old of the harm that has happened in our communities, you know, distilling all of that, and we're doing a good job. So March 1st, we had a a day of research, a community day of research and engagement at one of our churches in the south suburbs. So we had 12 researchers, and thank you, Darius was there, Northwestern University, CCH, and quite a few others. And we even had one of our research partners from Kansas University Medical Center flew in, and we had about 150 people, community people, and research partners, and Dorian Miller and Madeline Schellowitz. I think Capricorn was born that day. We talked about Capricorn, our clinical research data network, one of our researchers from Loyola. But we really had, we were there all day, 3 hours of presentations and a lot of really active participation. And then at the in the afternoon session, after we had sandwiches and lunch and whatnot, we had an open mic session where we actually had some really good dialogue about what research was, how they can be involved with it. And our research partners were really, really engaged with the conversations in the community. You know, and one thing that I remember is, and Darius, I think you remember this, there was a question about research, and everybody always thinks, the community thinks it's poking and needles and, you know, taking meds. And they were surprised to learn that research always did not involve meds and whatnot. So they didn't understand fully what research was, so that day of engagement really sparked and really got them activated to wanting to belong. And they've been asking ever since, how do they become ambassadors? Because we've got the patient engagement clusters at each program, but weekly I get the inquiry, how can we become ambassadors? Because they're ready to go with really becoming the ambassadors in their communities, in their churches, in their communities, and really spreading the words. And then we're going to also get started. We've got the Southland Healthcare Forum. We've got 12 hospital and health networks in the Southland, and we're all going to become partners. So that ambassador program is very important. So there's ownership and involvement for PCORI as far as getting the word out and becoming engaged with the underserved communities, communities with high risk.
Yes, Grant Jones, I've experienced oftentimes in the bridge that we attempt to build between research and community that on our research side, we walk across the bridge with our hand extended to community to join with us on something. But on the community side, oftentimes community doesn't quite know how to walk across and extend their hand to researchers to ask for something. So I'm curious as to what extent are you engaging the ambassadors in a way that has them creating and developing an ask of researchers?
So that's a good question, and I think that once we open the program up to the public, it's something that we're definitely going to have to, well, before we do that, get ready to, you know, to answer that. But I think that we have, you know, our seven principles of PCORI, and we are really interested in learning about, you know, how to empower patients to raise a hand, and when they don't actually understand a question that's being voiced to them. We have, you know, all this information about communication in the training and jargon watching. And so I think that we can definitely do a better job at, you know, making sure that patients are empowered to sit at the table. But we're definitely learning a lot from some of the projects that are funded in our portfolio of different trainings that they have done. And so it's definitely something that we're mindful of and making sure that we get a good handle on before we open it up to the public.
Have you had any examples of ambassadors making a request of something they'd like help with?
You know, I'm just going to back up just to add to what Anya said, is something that in the training that we give the ambassadors, we do train them on the rubric. And so we think that's a powerful tool to provide an ambassador so they can become the inviters to the research dialogue to help demonstrate here are the areas that I can provide you in your research, those areas in the rubric that we'll talk about later this afternoon. Your second question was?
we're just trying to, you mean for like a funding proposal or just?
No, not so much for funding, but to the extent that there are ideas that are, you're inviting ambassadors or their community constituents to help with. I'm just wondering whether or not the ambassadors bring anything to you that the community would like assistance with.
You know, we get requests from ambassadors to help them create presentations to take back to their communities. We haven't necessarily had like a research question come to us via the ambassadors, but as they form their areas of interest, their affinity groups, we hope that they will bring research questions to us and ideas to be innovative and to help us think about the communities that they serve. So that's definitely, you know, going to be a two-way street where we hope to benefit from having the ambassadors and we hope they benefit from having us.
I wonder if I can just jump in also. I mean, I think you bring up a really important question. And one of the things that was surprising to me is to find out that not an insignificant amount of the ambassadors are researchers. So one could think that the fact that researchers are signing up to be ambassadors is maybe to bridge that gap, but certainly something that we would want to explore because I think that's a really important link, you know, and a fundamental aspect of community participatory research.
Hello, Kevin.
Thank you. When you open up to the public, what will the strategy be to sort of maximize the impact? Because there's always going to be a limited number of ambassadors, and you know, some people are connected in formal and informal ways to other networks of influence. And so how are you thinking about that in terms of selection of ambassadors once it's open?
Yeah, so as of right now, when we open it up to the public, we'll definitely have to explore, you know, the intake form that we currently collect and making sure that the message is very clear. But I think that our strategy is that we definitely want to get representation from all eight of our stakeholder buckets and to look at where we're lacking right now. So we're definitely lacking in payers, individuals from the industry. As of right now, we don't have an issue with clinicians, but I think that our strategy will be able to just attract individuals who are not currently involved right now and also from different geographic groups and also representation from different ethnicities. We're also looking into, you know, the different learnings, you know, whether or not at different levels of learning, how can we engage those individuals, because we've heard that you have some individuals who have literacy issues and language. So those are a couple of areas that we're strategizing about.
And I'd like to add that we don't have a selection process for the ambassadors, that the process is that they must complete the training. And so everybody is welcome to become an ambassador as long as they complete our 5 modules of training, and we may include additional training. So we don't necessarily have a selection process. They kind of self-select. And then we will, you know, gauge by how involved ambassadors are, because we know that some ambassadors will be very involved, and we know other ambassadors will be less involved, and we're fine with that. But those who are really engaged and really involved, they will probably get tapped more to be engaged in research projects or to be on panels with us, and we'll know what their passion is.
Are you waiting the constituent groups for recruitment? Because I could imagine a scenario in which you get lots and lots of researchers who have a vested interest in driving research in one direction or another, and their voices may outweigh people who are representing patients and patient advocate groups.
You know, we're actually not waiting anything. You know, we are keeping the doors open and hoping to see that, just kind of like the quarry. You know, we are open as an organization to everyone. You know, all of their research ideas through the various venues that we have, an online portal. And so right now we're not limiting anything or waiting anything.
Hi, Mark. Oh,
Venus. Hey. Venus here. At Baylor, we concluded a project called EDIC. It stands for Eliminating Disparities in Clinical Trial. And it was a multicultural, multidisciplinary program where we went to 8 regions. And we really worked with racial and ethnic groups, the rural community, faith-based, community-based, and the majority of the bulk of the people that were involved were survivors. And I think since so much has been done with that project, it would be good to bring it up and have it available for the people that are working on this committee, on this program. Because a lot of work went through. We finished the project just to look at what is keeping minorities away from these clinical trials, clinical research. What are the myths, like Gina mentioned, you know, and how important it is to get that message across about the benefits of clinical research. And that's how we can break into some of these groups, because it's not just the African-American and Latino who have been victims of sterilization or Tuskegee. There's been other medical abuses that have taken place with Asians and Native Americans. So we need to bring them all in on this together. So I think I'd like to share that, because we've worked on it for so many years, and it was a great project.
Thanks for that. So I'll reach out to you and get that information, and we can definitely share that to one of our clusters is on minority issues, so we can definitely share that with them. So thank you, Dana. So Mark?
So thank you. Just a couple of general thoughts. I want to put it on the table that the ambassador program is still very young, and it's off to a really good start. But I am hearing from a lot of the questions, we're sort of looking at where is it along the continuum. So I just wanted to share a very short mental framework that I think gives context to what the ambassador program is now and what it could be over time. The framework is called the Arc of Public Engagement. And it's a framework you use when you want to engage the general public in different activities, whether it's to help them understand the issues you're working on or to accomplish some specific purpose. But it has three components. The first is you need to have a clearly identified problem. And with PCOR, we have that. Most people think that research already includes their perspectives, their views, and traditionally it has not. And so there's a problem that can be very clearly identified. You've seen when we've identified that for various groups, they resonate with it. You need to have a believable solution to that problem, which is the second component. And the CORI, PCOR, the work that we're all engaged in, is part of that solution. The solution is somewhat complex, but if we can make it believable, you have a clearly articulated problem with a believable solution. The third part that sort of completes this is it has to be salient. It has to be relevant enough to me that I'm willing to take action. And I'm picking up from the thread of a lot of the comments and questions that we're still sort of working on that specific action item. And so as we develop, and I know we have this meeting coming up, it starts to present those opportunities to identify what are those specific actions we want people to take. Can you go out and recruit people who would be available to participate in research? Can you recruit people to help identify questions for research? Can you recruit people who would help work with researchers to reframe culture? I think as we start to identify those as, we take this to the next level, and as we go public, it becomes a very, very powerful mechanism. But again, we have to recognize where we are. We're still in the beginning phases, off to a great start. We need to now take it to that next level. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. And we just have one comment that we want to acknowledge from a participant joining us online. And so she just wanted to make sure that we also consider individuals who have cognitive impairments, such as from the Parkinson's community, to make sure that when we do open it up to the public that we, you know, have that in mind. And so her name is Karine Schroeder. Sorry if I mispronounced, but thank you for that. And we actually have maybe about three individuals who have lived experience with Parkinson's who are currently ambassadors. So we'll definitely keep that in mind, and thank you for your comment.
We have one more question.
Yes, please.
Hi, Carmen here. Basically, it's really more a comment given my experience and lifelong work in community. We have all these buzzwords, meaningful, relevance, community building, benefits. I'd like just to see that through this process there's a reasonable level of expectation on both ends, where it could be cited one way or the other, where you have a little bit more on the research end and less on the community or less on the community. So just to have that balance, and that it's a reasonable expectation, and the expectation is put out directly in front, versus things that will later not have any sustainability and fall apart, which is another misled expectation in communities. We've heard many, many of the opportunities. There have been contributions through community partner research, obviously, and all those principles. Still working on those, but that the expectations be realistic and reasonable.
Thank you for that. And yes, we definitely want to make sure that when we open it up to the public, we have tangible, real opportunities. And so it's definitely something that we're hearing from current ambassadors, and we're working on that. So thank you. Hi, Regina.
I have one observation and comment. You know, one of the things I'm always concerned about is accessibility of information, especially for vulnerable populations. And so what also, you know, I worry about who has and has not the Internet. Not everybody has it. So we've had that conversation before. So I'd like to propose or maybe even recommend that we use or develop an app. We've got the new challenge coming around, possibly having the ambassador program in an app form. Because, you know, for my STAR initiative, I don't have an app yet, but I have a QR code. And those people who have signed up, they've scanned it, they go straight to the website and start interacting and use the information. So I'm thinking that might be a great access opportunity other than getting on a computer and use it and be part of the ambassador program through a mobile app.
Yeah, thank you for that. And so the training is available, you know, on your phone, but I definitely hear you for individuals that may not, you know, have access to the Internet, that we'll have to definitely provide some sort of alternative. So thank you. Paul?
Sorry, isn't Yammer available on, and that's the primary way ambassadors communicate with one another? I think it's available on an app. Or
yeah, absolutely. And so
is the training available on an app?
The training you can definitely take on your phone. But we don't have, you know, a full-blown app available, but I hear you. Thank you.
Just another comment that came up in our discussion this morning around vulnerable populations in particular studies in the Addressing Disparities group, and that is specific outreach to communities that sometimes it's been a bit marginalized in terms of research that's taken place, and in particular, the LGBT community came up in our discussion this morning, and to find out if there are any outreach that's taking place around the PCORI Ambassador Program to make sure that these groups are being brought in. It's wonderful to have people at the table like Julie, who, you know, worked with the Institute for Patient and Family-Centered Care and the work that you do at University of Arkansas, but thinking about other groups that are somewhat marginalized that need to be brought to the table.
I mean, we have definitely, you know, some time ago discussed that PCORI of having some targeted outreach to that community. So it's definitely, you know, something we're greatly interested in. We do have that's definitely in our legislation. So we have a group in Yammer dedicated to that as well. But I hear you. Regina, do you have another comment or is it just left? Okay.
Oh, good afternoon, everyone. I'm really pleased that we were able to orchestrate a joint meeting between the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel and the Patient Engagement Advisory Panel. I'll tell you that that, you know, this request did come from members of the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel. We took that to heart, and we're really thankful to Sue and her team for helping to make this happen. And we're really looking forward to hearing your comments. My goal here today, really, I have an hour with you in the context of this discussion. I'm going to spend about 30 minutes giving you some background information to show you right here. I'm giving you some background information about the Addressing Disparities Program. and tell you kind of, you know, what our program goals, what our mission is. And also, as all of you know, many of you have worked with underserved vulnerable populations, the goal of reducing and ultimately really in an ideal world eliminating disparities in health and in health care is a tall order. This is a challenging task. I would say that, you know, we have focused some energy on this topic for many years, and we haven't really moved the needle in the right direction. So for our charge at CORI, to really be able to measure our impact and to be able to see whether the investments that we are making in comparative effectiveness research to reduce disparities are actually getting us a return on that investment. And so part of what I'd like to be able to do with you today is show you how we're beginning to track where we are and where we may need to go in the future. And we would really welcome your input and your questions or your comments around this. This is an evolving program. We'll give you a sense of where we are right now. So I hope that this can be a dialogue. Again, we've allocated an hour for this, and I'm hoping that we can spend a good part of that in a discussion. But I have a lot of information to share with you. So you're welcome to interrupt me and ask questions along the way, or have me go through the presentation, and then we can launch into a good discussion. So I should also tell you, just by way of context, I've been with CORI for 18 months. And before I joined CORI, I was a researcher for 20 years, and my research focused on reducing disparities and improving quality of care for underserved populations. So I was on the other side of what I would call the funding equation. And it's, you know, it's a privilege to be on this side of the equation, but it's also very humbling. And I have deep appreciation for my colleagues who have been funders for years. I don't think I fully appreciated the level of work that it takes to really develop a comprehensive program, a cohesive program, and to be able to measure its impact. So I do have to say that. I also need to acknowledge my team. So this is the Addressing Disparities Program staff. I'm going to ask them to stand up so you can see who they are around the room. You can see their pictures there, but if you could please stand up. I have to tell you that the work that we do within the Addressing Disparities Program is we do a lot. We work fast. I couldn't do it without the team that you see here. We do everything from the pre-award, topic prioritization, doing the gap analysis, working on developing the funding announcements, working very closely with our board and board subcommittees, working with the other programs, merit review, and then also in terms of the post-award, really working to be champions for the projects that we are, in fact, supporting and funding and being able to tell the story. So this is really an outstanding team. And the work that you see that I'm going to present to you today is really as a result of the work that they've been doing within the Addressing Disparities Program. This is our advisory panel. You met all of them around the table, but I do have to give a shout out because the advisory panel has been really instrumental in helping to guide our work in terms of prioritizing. We fully expect that we will be working them hard in helping us to both disseminate and help with the uptake of the evidence that we develop through our funding mechanism. And I have to also specifically thank both Dorian and Grant for their leadership as co-chairs of the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel. So let's move into our mission and our program's guiding principles. Pretty straightforward, as you can see. Our mission is to reduce disparities in healthcare outcomes and advance equity in health and healthcare. We are here to support comparative effectiveness research that will identify the best options for eliminating disparities. What you see before you are, again, very straightforward, high-level program goals to identify research questions, high-priority research questions relevant to reducing and eliminating long-standing disparities in healthcare outcomes. Our advisory panel plays a key role in helping us to identify these high-priority questions. And then we work with our board and the subcommittees of our board to move forward with potential funding announcements around specific topics. We want to fund comparative effectiveness research with the highest potential to reduce and eliminate disparities. And we clearly, given our charge and our mandate, which is not just to fund the research, but to also change variations in practice, as specifically stated in the legislation, not only change variations in practice, but also to reduce disparities. And so many of you know that, you know, in many instances, we can see that progress may be being made where quality of care is being improved for the general population, but the closing of the gap takes a longer time. So we have, as I said, a tall order in terms of facilitating the dissemination of the work that we fund, being able to identify the promising or the best practices that can move forward to really changing practice to reduce and eliminate disparities. So in terms of where we are to date, so we have gone through four broad funding cycles. So these are our investigator-initiated projects. Within the Addressing Disparities program, we have funded a total of 31 projects across a wide variety of areas, and I'm going to show you a little bit of a breakdown in a few minutes. We have released one very targeted funding announcement focusing on treatment options for uncontrolled asthma in African American and Hispanic Latino populations, and have invested about $23, $24 million in this area. And then what we have in the pipeline, which means that these are in development, our first the first bullet there is obesity treatment options in diverse populations set in primary care. We actually released the funding announcement for this in February, in early February, and we are going to be receiving our full applications next week, and we hope to be making our awards in August 2014, and we've committed up to $20 million in this. Across all of CORI, so not just within the Addressing Disparities program, we also released our funding announcement for the pragmatic clinical trials. We hope are our high-impact projects. And within this, two topics that were prioritized by the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel were listed as priority topics within the pragmatic trial. One focuses on reducing cardiovascular risk in racial and ethnic minorities and rural populations, and the other topic focuses on the integration of mental health services within the context of primary care. And then what we have in the development stage are topics focusing on hypertension disparities, improving perinatal outcomes, and lower limb amputations. And these are in development because we've done a lot of work. We've held work groups. We've done gap analysis. We're talking about partnerships, but we have not yet moved forward with approval from our board and our board subcommittees to move forward with a full funding announcement, and hope to be able to take these topics to our board within the next 2 months, except for the last topic, lower limb amputations, which we do plan on holding a work group in this area, a multi-stakeholder work group, which we hope we can convene later this fall. So our ACLA funding announcement was our first targeted funding announcement, and we have awarded 8 awards in this area, and you can see that the focus of these projects are, number one, focusing, all of them focus on asthma disparities, but to compare interventions to improve both clinician and patient adherence to the NHLBI guidelines, with the recognition that the guidelines are not unidimensional, they're multidimensional, so we would expect that interventions need to be multidimensional to be able to address some of the disparities that we see within this context. And you can see the bulleted areas where most of these projects are focusing. They are, of course, patient-centered, and there is a strong stakeholder engagement component in all 8 of these projects. These pie charts, the big pie chart gives you a breakdown of the Addressing Disparities portfolio snapshot in terms of the different conditions or areas that we have funded to date. You can see that the majority of our projects focus on chronic conditions. The smaller pie chart, the 36%, breaks down the chronic conditions into more granular categories. We have the biggest chunk of that pie is for asthma, clearly, because we have a targeted funding announcement and have funded 8 projects in that area. But you can see the general breakdown. It just gives you a general snapshot. It also just gives us a kind of a high-level snapshot of seeing where we've invested and where we may need to further invest in the future. So the Addressing Disparities program focuses on multiple target populations that we believe are at risk for experiencing disparities in healthcare. These populations that you can see listed here are a subset of a larger list, which we call the priority populations for PCORI. So what you see is the bar graph with the target populations, and then you can see of the projects that we have funded where we have targeted some of these groups. So the vast majority of our projects focus on racial and ethnic minorities, low-income populations. We have some projects in rural populations. These are not mutually exclusive. People are not unidimensional. They come with multiple characteristics. Vulnerabilities are not mutually exclusive. So there's some overlap. But we can see through this that we may be really needing to look at some of the target populations where we haven't invested as much relative to some of the others. I think it's important to note in terms of, again, the portfolio snapshot, the research methods. So the vast majority of the projects, so again, we have a total of 39. Of those 39, 33, so about 85% of the portfolio, has a randomized control trial component. We do have a small subset, which are quasi-experimental or observational studies. I think it's really important to recognize what role some of these non-randomized controlled trial studies play. So I'm just going to take you back to this bar graph to show you the patient populations. So there is a great deal of evidence about disparities for racial and ethnic minorities across a number of conditions, a wide variety of settings. We also know quite a bit in terms of disparities related to socioeconomic characteristics. But if you go further down that bar graph, we have very little evidence in terms of LGBT populations, individuals with disabilities. So these target populations, in terms of studies that are being submitted to us, many of them are frankly just not ready for interventions or randomized controlled trials. There's some kind of initial work that needs to be done. And I get asked this question quite a bit because one of the things that I have said ever since I came to PCORI to lead the program is that, we've spent a great deal of our national effort describing the existence of disparities. So I like to say, if you tell us that disparities exist, we'll believe you. But there are, for some populations, and we went through a discussion this morning, we went through a prioritization process this morning for four topics, one being individuals with disabilities, another focusing on the LGBT community. And when we looked at the synthesis of the evidence and whether there were trials that had taken place, the literature is really scant. The evidence base is simply just not there. So I think that, as the disparities program encompasses a broader population set, we really need to be mindful of the types of studies we're funding. And we really want those studies, some of them kind of at the early stages, so meaning they may not be ready for that, randomized controlled trial or a pragmatic trial. But we're hoping that the studies that we do fund and start to create that evidence base can lead into strong comparative effectiveness studies to really improve healthcare outcomes for populations where, frankly, the evidence just is not there right now. So I'm just going to give you a little example here. So this is one of our projects. This is a project that we have funded with Ken Wells and his team at UCLA. It's a wonderful project. This project focuses on long-term outcomes of community engagement to address depression outcome disparities. So Ken and his team, and there is a very strong engagement component here. In fact, this is a great project in terms of really bringing it up as a model for community engagement and patient engagement. But like many of our projects, the methodology here is a mixed methods approach. So randomized controlled trials, but also some qualitative work and some narrative work that's taking place to really provide the context and the story, if you will, behind the numbers. So many of our projects kind of fall into this framework. I'm going to stop for a minute. Sarah, did you have a question for me?
Well, on the last slide, yes. And I guess when you talk about particularly thinking about the disabilities community and a lot of the projects not necessarily being right for an intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I guess, then brings me back to, and I'm not sure what the role is of this panel in identifying where work needs to be done to get to a point where you can do those interventions and have a comparative project. Because, for example, with disabilities, we know that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to identify where the gaps are and where the problem lies. But those are not comparative projects, right? So where does that fit then in the PCORI process to do some work to identify, you know, to better get that landscape put together?
I think that's a great question. So all the comparative studies that, so we ask for comparative effectiveness. We do not say comparative effectiveness studies that have to be randomized controlled trials. Right. We can do comparative effectiveness studies that are observational or quasi-experimental or even qualitative. So we have tried to really state that within our funding announcement, but I think the message that we're kind of overlaying is that, you know, the randomized controlled trial is the gold standard. So we are seeing a lot of applications that are coming to us that, frankly, I'll tell you, are just simply not ready for a randomized controlled trial. So let me just move forward with the next example. So we have funded some studies in the area of disabilities. This is one. This does not have a randomized controlled trial component. It's a study based at the University of Pennsylvania. Really, it's a project focused on really understanding what people with disabilities need to help stay healthy, working within the context of primary care, quality of care. And, again, very strong patient engagement component, focusing on issues of both how do you get to your appointments, care coordination, how do you work across multiple teams and providers and clinicians, with the goal of developing this tool, this patient-inspired surveillance tool, to provide guidance for people with disabilities, particularly within the context of really placing disabilities in the sphere of disparities. So again, this is not, there's not a randomized controlled trial component here, but this study really, you know, we're very excited about it. We think it's going to make a real contribution in an area where there hasn't been a contribution to date. So I think part of this is, you know, we don't want to hold so fast and true to this notion that everything that we fund has to be a randomized controlled trial. But we would like to see a comparative component, and it doesn't have to be embedded within a trial, especially for for areas or for populations where, again, we just don't have that evidence base yet. So some of this preliminary work needs to be done. Kevin?
Yeah, just to follow up on that question. In some cases, though, the science is even further back, mm-hmm. and one needs even more basic science. And the problem is there isn't an institute of disabilities. There isn't an institute of LGBT health. And so where is that going to come from to get evidence to the point where one can even begin to do even non-randomized comparative effectiveness studies?
So, I mean, I think that this is actually an area, I mean, so short of saying that, you know, we can develop institutes that actually focus on specific populations, but again, I think, you know, one thing that we have been trying to be very mindful of within the Addressing Disparities program, and I think this is probably true, you know, and this communication needs to happen across the programs at PCORI, is again, where there isn't an evidence base, I still think that we can fund good science. Now, what we don't want to do is fund purely descriptive work that says, you know, we see this disparity, it exists, and then stop there, right? The question is, can you motivate an actual project beyond just the evidence of the disparity existing and saying it exists within this group? But what we can do within the context of you know, the funding from PCORI is really try to put something into practice that would go beyond just describing a problem to moving towards a solution. And we would like to see that within the context of a proposal. And we would like to see that within the context, frankly, given our mandate and what we are mandated to fund in the context of comparative effectiveness research. So let me see if there are any other questions or comments.
So one of the groups I'm with is Consumers United for Evidence-Based Medicine. And we have, among our constituents, is an LGBT organization. And one of the issues they've raised that I think is important is they've said that their data isn't being captured. So, for instance, as we start moving towards things like electronic medical records, if we're not capturing the data of the underlying population, it becomes very hard to do any type of comparative effectiveness research. And, you know, in that circumstance, just knowing, for instance, knowing who identifies in that population and what their healthcare utilization measures are might be a useful start.
I completely agree with you. And to that end, I don't know why this keeps echoing. And if it's sounding a little bit off, I'm sorry. But I think that's an excellent point. And in fact, you know, again, to give a very specific example, so within the Addressing Disparities Program, we have funded a project that focuses on data collection within the healthcare setting for LGBT communities at Johns Hopkins. So the comparative component of this is comparing different or the best mechanisms that are patient-centered through strong patient engagement, strong stakeholder engagement, to figure out the best way to capture data from LGBT populations within the context of the healthcare setting. So this is one of the, you know, this is the first study that's being done in this particular area. Hopefully it sets a foundation. And the learning from that can be disseminated and hopefully start to link somewhat even with what's happening through through ONC and meaningful use and what is expected to be collected in terms of demographic data. So I completely agree with you, and we're, you know, beginning to invest in these topics, but again, we have to be mindful of what our mandate is as well. So thank you for that comment. We had a comment here.
Yes, I want to understand a little better about how you determine the comparisons
across all of our just across the board.
You were just saying that you use this comparison, best methods. I'd like to understand that.
So yeah, I think this is a good question, and it's, you know, a topic that we definitely have within PCORI and across a number of groups in terms of, you know, what is a good comparator. Because if you look at some of our funding announcements, we've said that usual care is an appropriate comparator, right? So, for instance, we get some projects where, you know, we have an active intervention arm, and then we have usual care as the comparator. And in some instances, usual care may be the right comparator. It may be because it's, you know, stated within a guideline, it's what's being done. It is the best possible approach, and there's no, you know, there's no other way of delivering care for a given treatment or intervention. And in that case, usual care might be appropriate. In some instances, usual care isn't appropriate because you may have a usual care where nothing is being done, and then you have an intervention where there is kind of an active intervention, and the expectation will be that the intervention arm is clearly going to be much better. So, you know, we have discussed this, and it really depends within the context of the study, what's being studied, you know, and whether it's, if we're focusing on a methodology that's a randomized controlled trial with one or two or three arms, whether we're focusing on an observational study that is comparing, you know, differences in care for different groups, it's going to be dependent on the context of the study itself. So there's not going to be a one kind of, you know, there's not one mechanism that says this is the absolute right comparator and this can apply to every study that PCORI funds.
With respect to the I'll have to come back.
Ramona, would you like for people to hold their questions until you finish the session and then go on, or you?
The comment.
Martin. We'll hold questions until the end.
Just to follow up on Lorraine's comment, if anyone's interested, the National Partnership for Women and Families, part of nationalpartnership.org, has put out an action plan for leveraging the meaningful use of electronic health record data, and actually it's an excellent piece that includes recommendations and an action plan, both for LGBT as well as disabilities based on recent comments solicited by Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. So I think that might be something of interest to you.
So let me move on a little bit and give you a sense of how we're tracking our projects. And again, this is evolving. But I'm hoping that you'll begin to see how we're at least beginning to make sense of a what I would call a pretty diverse portfolio, which continues to become more and more diverse. So, you know, disparities is not, it's, when I talk to people about disparities research, it's a little bit like world hunger, you know, or you can approach world hunger through an economic framework, land policy, food policy. You have to do it kind of across, you know, multiple dimensions. It's not, you can't just address it through one venue. Disparities is very similar. It inherently requires a multidimensional approach. There are many factors that drive disparities in care, and as such, the interventions that we start to really focus on for reducing disparities in many ways have to also be multidimensional. So one of the things that we started to do on the programmatic side is to really say, you know, what kind of a model or a conceptual framework can we really lay the program on in terms of providing us with guideposts in terms of the direction that we're going. And, you know, some of this is actually built on the notion that, you know, knowledge is built on theory, so kind of a theoretical framework or a conceptual framework, and then theories are the, you know, the things that one tests to move to action, to drive change. So I went back and started to look at the various models or conceptual frameworks that have been in the literature for the last 10 years or so, thinking that we would put together somewhat of a hybrid with a PCORI overlay. The more I did that, the more complicated it got. And finally, what I recognized was that Lisa Cooper's model in 2002, she released in 2002 in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, kind of captures this multidimensional aspect of what we're trying to achieve. So we've adopted Lisa Cooper's framework. It, if you look at the outcomes on the far right-hand side, you know, there's a strong patient-centered component to these outcomes in terms of the patient's views of the care they receive, health status relates to mortality, morbidity, functioning, well-being. So these are all very patient-centered outcomes. And then the factors that may drive some of these disparities or could actually reduce some of these disparities are on the left-hand side of this model. Again, many of our projects fall into many of these components on the left-hand side, and then on the right-hand side, many of our projects, in fact, focus on outcomes that generally fall within the same outcomes that Lisa has identified. So this provides us, if you will, kind of with our foundational underpinning. It's kind of our grounding. So what we wanted to do is say, okay, so, yeah, this is great conceptually, but then how do we kind of get a handle of our program and the projects that we are supporting within the Addressing Disparities program? So we decided to build a driver model. And for those of you who are used to driver models where they go from right to left, I apologize. I cannot make sense of those models. They are intuitively off for me. So if you know there's a huge outcry about this, I'm willing to change the direction. But part of this was because, you know, the conceptual model moves from left to right. So just cognitive processing wise, it makes sense for the model, for me at least, to move from left to right. There are people who have said, why are you doing this? This is upstream and this is downstream. So I have to definitely make a comment about that. But ultimately, what we ended up doing is saying, okay, we recognize that, you know, reducing disparities in healthcare outcomes requires a multidimensional approach. And we recognize that, you know, policy-level interventions, organizational-level interventions, point of care, all of these have to play together to really get to our goal. So in essence, the primary drivers are kind of the higher level factors we need to influence to reach our goals. That's maybe the most simplistic way of thinking about this. The secondary drivers and the tertiary drivers are specific activities or projects. So for us, in this particular diagram, the secondary drivers are elements or concepts that can influence policy organization, or point of care. And then the tertiary drivers are, frankly, the areas where the majority of our projects have been focusing. So they are really kind of just very succinct, clear descriptors of what our projects have been focusing on. And I'm going to show you a little bit of a mapping exercise that we've done to hopefully make sense of how we're using this. I do want to point out that this model is evolving. It is not static in any way. It will hopefully help us evaluate where we are and also help us identify where we need to go in terms of where we're making our investments. So let me give you an example. So I'm going to use an example from the Addressing Disparities Program, another one of our projects, focusing on, you can see the title here, A Helping Hand to Activate Patient-Centered Depression Care Among Low-Income Patients. So the study compares two safety net clinic depression care models among patients with major depression and with comorbid conditions. Patients are randomized to either usual patient-centered medical home care or to the patient-centered medical home care plus self-management through training with community health workers. So we took this and mapped this to our driver model, and we said, okay, so one component of this intervention is focusing on self-management. We know that self-management can enhance access to care because it empowers individuals to hopefully care for themselves. It also has a strong component focused on training and education, and it also clearly has a strong component that focuses on patient engagement. The project also focuses on the use of community health workers to provide the training around self-management. So it incorporates an expansion of the healthcare workforce, if you will. And we have quite a number of projects, actually, that are using promotoras or community health workers to really expand care outside of the healthcare setting, outside the four walls. We recognize that, you know, healthcare outcomes are not determined only by what happens within the four walls of a clinic or a hospital. So we're able to see that, okay, so this project in particular, these tertiary drivers focus on these secondary drivers within our program. And then all of these are actually focused on a point of care intervention. So this project itself doesn't have focus on looking at kind of organizational drivers. It really looks at, you know, are we improving outcomes at the point of care for patients with major depression and comorbid conditions. Now, we fully recognize that these arrows for all of these boxes can go in 20 different directions. They are all interrelated. So we would expect that if we start to see a strong evidence base around point-of-care interventions, it may actually influence what happens at the organizational level, and it may actually even influence policy. So, you know, there's often this bias for action and then learning. We have seen where we implement policies, paper performance policies and so forth, where we put the policies forward, but we don't know what the impact of those policies are, and we go back and study them later. So in some ways, we're hoping that some of the work that we fund is able to inform organizational or higher level state policy, but the actual studies that we're funding within the program are not kind of driving towards policy level comparing the implementation of the ACA or looking at how the exchanges are working in different states. So at some point we had to make a cutoff and recognize that this is all very interconnected, but to begin to kind of reduce the data and to be able to see the story, we needed to make a decision about kind of how we were going to focus our learnings about our program. And so for us as a funding institute, we really wanted to see, you know, kind of how is our funding potentially driving a movement towards reducing disparities. So what we did is we basically took all of the projects within the Addressing Disparities program and we mapped it to the driver model. So here you can now get a sense of the projects and the number of projects that we have funded in specific areas. And you can see, so these are not mutually exclusive because as I showed you in the first example, we had a project that took both self-management and work using community health workers within the same project. So you can see where the focal points are for many of these projects. But when you look at the primary drivers, the thing that really jumps out here is that none of our projects really focus on any primary policy-level drivers. So that tells us something. So we're really focused, and it makes sense, actually. If you think about our mandate and what we're funding and the focus on patient-centeredness and patient engagement, that many of our projects are actually focused at the point of care or enhancing communication. But in terms of this overarching mission to reduce disparities, should we be thinking about partnering with other funders on policy-level factors where we can at least begin to invest in looking at some of the patient-centered outcomes? But it begins to help us unravel a little bit this kind of vast bucket of projects that we have started to fund, and give us a sense of, you know, where we are and, again, where we may need to go in order to be able to accomplish our goals. So I just highlight these because you can see that the vast majority of our projects, you know, there's a strong focus on self-management, use of community health workers, and on cultural and language tailoring within the development of tools and so forth. And then as far as secondary drivers, most of them have focused on access to care, again, training and education, which makes sense, and patient empowerment. We actually took this model and applied it across of all of Macquarie's projects that focused on disparities. So I want to bring you to this slide just for a second, because when I first joined Macquarie, one of the conversations that I had with Joe Selby was, you know, this really terrific discussion actually about, you know, how I was thrilled that Macquarie had identified addressing disparities as one of its national priorities for research. But I also know through, you know, 20 years of doing disparities research and working with organizations and providing technical assistance, that it's terrific if you call out disparities, but there's a price to that. And the price to calling out disparities is this, well, you know, all those really nice people over there are taking care of this. So it doesn't have to be integrated throughout the organization, throughout the system. However, if you integrate it throughout the organization or throughout a system, it often gets subsumed. So this was one of the kind of the tensions that I was really wondering about when I came to Macquarie. And actually, Alina Chen, who's one of our addressing disparities panelists, raised this at our first, at our very, very first advisory panel meeting a year ago. And, you know, this notion of is it integrated or is it really just a standalone program and, you know, everything disparities related is within this program only. So we did a quick analysis and we looked at the target populations that I listed in that bar graph. So we looked at projects that focused on those target populations. And what you can see here, and these are through our investigator-initiated projects, so our broad funding announcements, the integration happened quite naturally. So across all of Macquarie's programs, 66% of Macquarie's portfolio has a focus on disparities populations. And I, again, refer you back to the target populations that I showed you in that bar graph. So that tells us that there is a nice level of integration that's taking place. Now, we haven't really dug down into each of these projects. There are a lot of them across the different programs within Macquarie to see whether they've empowered adequately to really look at those subpopulation differences and so forth. But I think it's important to recognize that that integration took place somewhat naturally through the investigator-initiated projects. So this is just a different way to kind of look at the data, again, simplifying it quite a bit. But what we can see here is that for all the addressing disparities projects, self-management is one of the tertiary drivers. It's a vast majority of our projects, whether they focus on chronic conditions, whether they focus on depression, on a number of other areas, a vast majority of them focus on interventions that are related to self-management. And for the projects that are not within the addressing disparities portfolio but have a disparities focus, self-management is the second highest tertiary driver. The secondary drivers across the programs, both addressing disparities and other programs, the secondary driver, most of the projects are really focusing on training and education. So we're investing a lot in training and education. And again, if you think about this, in relationship to our mandate and our focus on patient engagement, patient empowerment, tailoring of care for populations, in some ways it makes sense that this is what we're seeing through our broad investigator-initiated projects. So where do we go from here? We are very focused on learning, disseminating, and implementing. As you all know, we engage patients and other end users from start to finish, but we also are really actively at this point in time beginning to really think about developing learning communities. So one of the first learning communities that we're going to be pulling together focuses around our asthma projects. We have 8 within the Addressing Disparities program, and then there are a couple of other asthma projects within the other programs as well. So we really hope to use these learning communities as a mechanism to foster cross-learning among project teams. But more importantly, we really want to bring together the research community with the end users, which includes patients, payers, employers, purchasers, clinicians, professional societies, policymakers, and training institutions to really be able to start having that dialogue now rather than at the end of the project. So the end users can start to inform the research community and the research teams about the types of information that they may need. And we envision doing this across a number of areas and topics. But we take the notion of kind of really learning and beginning to make some contribution around the disseminating side of our work and our mandate. We are taking that as a charge in terms of being able to really be able to evaluate the impact of the work that we are funding. So as many of you know, we have different mechanisms for funding. We have our broad funding announcements. We have our targeted funding announcements. We have our pragmatic clinical trials. And then through the engagement program, we have the engagement awards. And I'll tell you that, when I go around speaking to different groups across the country, they're clearly very interested in what we're funding and the venues for funding on the scientific side, but they are really, really interested in the engagement awards. There are a lot of questions that come up about the engagement awards. So I know that the engagement team and the advisory panel has done a lot of work in this area. I've just very blatantly borrowed from the slides that have been developed by the engagement team. I plagiarize openly to be able to communicate the benefit of beginning to really develop the foundation for groups to come together with the research community to be able to be successful in applying to PCORI through these different funding mechanisms that we have. So our goal is to continue to work with our Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel. We'd like to develop a more sophisticated understanding of the practices that are effective in reducing disparities in care at multiple levels, produce a strong evidence base of promising and best practices, and finally, to really be able to see that our work is actually making an impact in terms of changing practice. And I recognize, the challenge in this in terms of the timeline that we have. But we're working as fast as we can, and we're trying to do it in a mindful way, and would really appreciate your comments, suggestions, questions. And I appreciate the comments that have already been brought up and would be happy to take more.
Ramona, perhaps we can start with finding out whether or not Terry, do you have a follow-up question on the earlier question you had? Okay.
When you talk about 66% of the projects having a disparities angle, I guess where I'm a little confused is, I would imagine that, I guess I envisioned that 100% of PCORI's projects would be capturing race and ethnicity, LGBT status, functional ability related to people with disabilities. I mean, how is it that that's not being incorporated into every PCORI project, that you're capturing the impact of the intervention on subpopulations as identified within each project?
Well, many of the projects focus on the subpopulations or PCORI's priority populations. So the list of priority populations is much longer than the target populations within the disparities program. So the disparities program list is a much shorter list. It's the subset of the priority populations.
So what we showed you was only a subset of the disparities target populations, not the entire priority population set for PCORI.
But I guess what I'm saying is that any project that was funded by PCORI, wouldn't it be capturing the impact of the intervention on all these different populations, whether it's through the disparities program or through some other?
Not necessarily. There may be some, first of all, it's not going to be all the populations. Part of this is a numbers issue and being able to make meaningful conclusions based on.
Did I do that?
Yeah. My goodness. Sorry. So I lost my train of thought. I was completely shocked by that. I'm sorry. It was probably the most exciting thing that happened. Numbers. Right. Yeah. Clearly we want to focus on the priority populations. And many of the projects do focus on priority populations, and they give us an analysis and a breakdown in terms of the groups that they're addressing. But they're not going to be sufficiently powered to be able to make meaningful conclusions. So no, I wouldn't say that 100% of the projects all address the target populations for disparities, even though they may address the longer list of the priority populations.
Elsie, is this a question on this point?
Okay. I just wanted to add that in terms of addressing disparities, just capturing the information is not necessarily going to get you to the end point of being active in trying to address the disparity in question. So I guess what I'm saying is I think I'm kind of following along with what you're saying, is saying that to capture the information is one thing, but to actively engage in a process to do something to reduce the disparity is a little bit different, right?
Okay. Charlotte Mandera.
Okay. Thank you for that. Very informative. One thing that occurred to me about maybe part of the reason that there are zero projects that are funded thus far that relate to the primary driver of policy is that I've been in policy research for a really long time. You don't see a whole lot of randomized clinical trials related to policy, and the types of investigators who are incentivized by PCORI as a funder are not, for the most part, policy researchers. And I'm also one who does an annual report on asthma and allergy policies in states related to schools and to care at schools. And it's very difficult to come up with an apples and apples if we narrow the state laws down to just those, that environment. So that could be part of the reason.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really excellent point. But I think what it does call out for us at PCORI and within the disparities program is the importance of dialogue with the organizations that are doing the policy level analysis. Yes.
So to that point, I picked up on that as well as being a really striking finding around the 0% influencing policy, and was just trying to tie it together with some of the work that the PEEP is doing and thinking about our rubric. And, is there a need for us in a rubric 2.0 to provide specific examples of what you just said, Ramon, in terms of, well, how would you as a team bring those policymakers together up front so that you're designing a project intentionally to influence policy? So, I think that we all get that that's important, but providing the specific examples in a rubric might be important for folks moving forward. And then the other thing I was going to say is I similarly think that the engagement awards are fabulous and really important, and I'm just going to throw this out because I can. Is it possible for each portfolio, so disparities, prevention treatment, to also have some funds designated for engagement awards on top of the funds that already exist? And that might be a way that each panel would be able to then target some engagement awards in specific substantive areas that you might be interested in.
So I'm delighted on many fronts that you think the engagement awards are
exciting, especially because we just offered a job to a director for the engagement awards, and she accepted. That always gives me a lot of confidence. But, you know, the engagement awards, in my mind, serve both an internal and external audience. And so our internal audience is, of course, the whole enterprise, all the national priorities. And, of course, the external audience is very tied to the internal audience. So we see the engagement awards as holistically in terms of supporting the mission of it, the organization, and including you know, the national priorities and all of the activity around them. So very much in that same vision.
Itchen? Yes. And then Martin.
The question I have is, you know, sometimes when you have policy that drive, you expect policy to drive or reduce disparity, and sometimes they don't end up doing that. And what happens is that once the policy is put in place, there's actually nobody that goes back to look at what happens after the policy is put in place. I'll give an example. In Nevada, for a while, everybody knew it was important for women who wanted to get tuberculosis to sign a consent 3 months or 1 month before they actually get it, which is a way to allow them to change their mind if they need to change their mind so they can still do that. But one thing we found out down the road is that the state added another component and said, if you do C-section and then you don't do the tuberculosis at that time, if you do it at that time, you will not be paid. You have to separate them. So you have to bring them back and put them under anesthesia. Those two things were put in place. What we noticed is that, tuberculosis dropped dramatically in our state. I don't know if that was intended, consequent of what they wanted it to be, but what was in the policy was they wanted to reduce the disparity and allow the women remove bias remarks and allow them to change their mind. But at the end, what it did actually denied access to people who wanted it because, A, they have to sign 1 month, and, B, they can't be done when they're doing C-section, they have to come back. But nobody has gone back to actually look at such policy. So in terms of this, even though we are funding policies, is there a way to actually fund programs that actually look at policies after they've been implemented and what impact they have on what they're intended to do?
So your question is, can we fund research that looks at the impact of policies after they've been implemented?
Yes, policies that are designed to reduce disparities.
Yeah.
To actually look at those policies after they've been implemented.
Right. I think that there is an opportunity. I think there's an opportunity in terms of PCORI and the Addressing Disparities Program potentially funding a study that, again, has a comparative component. And I do think that the ACA offers a huge learning laboratory in terms of comparative studies looking at the impact of policies. That said, I think, and this point has come up in other discussions relating to this, I think the challenge is in bringing together the right groups, focusing on the patient-centered outcomes within the context of policy. And I think that there's, a nuance and an art to doing that. So it's something that I think, we should definitely think about entertaining at PCORI. And the reason I say that is because we recognize that policy is a huge driver. And if we completely ignore it, then we're ignoring a huge driver. Should it be what makes up the large body of what we fund? I don't think so. But I think that we should be partnering and engaging and talking to the right groups. And potentially there may be an area where we could invest and fund a study that focuses on the implementation of a given policy to see its impact on disparities.
As a lot of the policy research you could do may not be easy to randomize, to look at randomized, but I still think that things like before and after studies are still important. And if you have a policy that is implemented to reduce disparity, will you fund something that wanted to look at before that policy came in, the disparity that we know existed, and after that policy came in and see whether it actually makes sense? Sometimes those policies have unintended consequences, but nobody goes back to actually address them because they make things worse, not better.
I think I think attempting to undertake policy research at this point is premature. I think that the work that the Addressing Disparities and Engagement Panels have undertaken is the right approach. I think you need to build the evidence base. I think that you're right on target in addressing at least three or four of the six priorities from the National Quality Strategy that the CORI is authorized to align with. They involve person and family engagement as partners, effective communication and coordination, wide use of best practices, quality care that's more affordable. And to the extent that the fruits of your projects, you know, create an evidence base that allows you to then say, you know, here are some of the areas in policy that we could possibly impact, to the extent that you could align your work and your research evidence with those of federal partners, particularly because you're filling their gaps, I think you build a much stronger case, and I think that's what you were saying.
It's exactly what I was saying. He said it so well.
So when one thinks of policy, one can think of policy at very multiple levels. You know, one can think of local policy, one can think of policy at a hospital, a healthcare plan, state, federal, so on. And I think in some cases, I think it probably would be appropriate to look at research in this area, but I think there's two things probably that are really critical. One is finding out whoever controls that policy or has a significant sway, what they think are the critical questions, and then what level of evidence do they think likely, and it's always a guess, would help to sway that policy, and then that could help to drive some of those research questions.
Would you fund a project that was addressing development of methodology rather than if it didn't have a comparative?
Right. So yes, we would at the CORI because we have a whole program that focuses on advancing PCOR methods. And so the projects that we receive within the context of that program are exactly what you just stated in terms of advancing the methodology and focusing on the methodology.
Is that for diversity?
It can be. It certainly can be. And there are a number of projects that actually do focus on diverse populations in terms of enhancing or advancing the methods.
Also, the methodology report has identified gaps in that area where they actively are looking for research in that area. So, you know, by identifying where there are methodological gaps, that really helps stimulate the field to fill those gaps.
With respect to electronic methods, or patient diet.
Right. So if it focuses on the project of kind of advancing the methods, then it would go to the methods program.
Time for one last question or comment, Lorraine.
Yes, this is just drawing a parallel from the work we've been doing on PEEP, and that is in talking about populations that haven't yet defined their area well enough to be able to do comparative studies. Another thought would be to do something analogous to the pipeline to proposal grants that we do, which would be a preparedness type of program to allow those patient populations to address that gap so that they are then primed at the pump ready to go.
Thank you. It just makes me recognize that we haven't introduced the pipeline proposals to this group yet. And so stay tuned, because what Lorraine just brought up is something we just launched, we just funded. It's small micro contracts, and it's not research. It's the pre-engagement. It's to There's small micro contracts of $15,000 that individuals can get, small groups can get, clinicians can get, junior researchers can get, to begin forming that community engagement, to begin the partnership forming, to get them to start talking about a potential CEI question. And there's actually three tiers. So maybe next time we meet, we can give you an update on that. So we'll have some really nice examples of what we've observed over the last 6 months.
I don't know if there are any more comments or questions, but I really appreciate all the comments and all the questions. They're actually very helpful. I think that we are teed up for a break.
Yep.
10 minutes.
10-minute break, and then when we reconvene, we're going to have a presentation on dissemination and implementation plan.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's not a safe Thank you. Good afternoon. Please be seated. Good afternoon and welcome back. We are going to start the next session. My name is Orlando Gonzalez. I'm the Chief of Staff for Engagement with PCORI. And just to sort of give you a little forewarning about some of the activities we're about to do, we will end up in some working groups, so we're going to split off and go into the lobby of the hotel. When the session is over at 4:15, you're expected to be back in the room for the following session. So just so that you know that we're starting here, we're going to break off, we're going to go outside, and then we won't come back together to reconvene on the same topic. We're going to move on to the next session. So earlier in the general session, it was asked if PCORI was developing a plan for dissemination and implementation, and Joe Selby reported that in the fall of 2013, we issued an RFP for the development of a plan. And so this past January, we selected Mathematica Health Policy Research to help PCORI with this endeavor. A lot of the feedback that we have received so far is how important it is to be tremendously inclusive of multiple stakeholder perspectives. And so one of the first steps that we're going to do is in the work today is to get perspectives from you all about the definition that we're going to start with on dissemination and implementation. So we want to build a shared understanding of what the definition is in the plan. So without any further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to the project lead of the project, which is Dominic Esposito with Mathematica, and he will introduce the project, the team, and all the deliverables that go with it. So, Dominic?
Sure. Great. Thank you, Orlando. I'm just looking for our set of slides now. Apologize for that. Thanks, Rachel. There we go. Okay.
By the way, I want to thank Sarah and Darius for part of the reviewer panel when we chose Mathematica. So thanks for doing that as part of the membership of the advisory council.
Thank you, everyone, for your attention and your time. As Orlando said, we're going to have an audience participation portion of the show. I'm going to try to be brief so that we can keep you all on schedule this afternoon. I'm Dominic Esposito with Mathematica Policy Research, and on behalf of the entire team working on this from Mathematica, Academy Health, Palladium Partners, and WebMD, we really want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today and get your thoughts. So briefly, what are we going to do today? I'm going to do an introduction to the project in addition to just some brief team introductions so everyone gets a sense of who's here. I'll give a project overview on how we're going to be developing the dissemination and implementation action plan for PCORI, or just action plan for short. Then comes the audience participation part. With the help of PCORI, what we've done is broken the two panels up into four groups. We'd like to, in these four groups, kind of talk about different factors that are going to go into our action plan. In particular, discuss dissemination and implementation separately. So we have two groups on dissemination and two on implementation, although we do know that the lines are kind of blurred again, that we'll probably talk about both in all four groups at some point. Specifically, we want to talk about examples of successful dissemination implementation strategies. We want to talk about facilitators and challenges to dissemination implementation, and we want to talk about the ways in which dissemination or implementation can account for the needs of various audiences that we're trying to get information to or have information be used in a better way in practice. So just to note, the highlights from those discussions, what we're going to do is share them via email through PCORI rather than come back after the groups. This is just to allow as much time as possible. As you probably know, it's actually cooler out there than it is in here, so hopefully it'll be a good way to actually cool off as well. So the goals for today's discussion are really as follows. I want to share with you, on behalf of the team, plans for developing the action plan. And we want to hear your thoughts on dissemination implementation of health and healthcare evidence, focusing on engagement of stakeholders and priority populations to PCORI, identification of best practices, facilitating barriers, and evaluation strategies to the extent that we can talk about that today. So let me try and be brief with this introduction, but try and cover as much as also practical. I'd just like to tee up that it would be, you know, we're happy to take any comments at all on the design, but we actually reserve that for, you know, give me or Jennifer DeValence, who is also here in the room today, our co-principal investigator, call at any time to discuss those details. We would like to focus today on kind of getting your feedback in the small groups in a different way, but we're happy to take your comments at any time on how we designed it for sure. The four organizations working on this team are Mathematical Policy Research. Here today are myself, Jennifer DeValence, who's a co-principal investigator, Sarah Farso from our Chicago office is here, and Jessica Haringa from our Michigan office is here as well. Jessica and Sarah will be leading two of the breakout groups on dissemination. From Academy Health, we have Allison Ryan here today. She is one of the task leaders at Academy Health. She's here. I apologize, Allison. I forgot you were there. And she'll be leading one of the implementation breakout groups, and I'll be leading the other implementation breakout group. From Palladium Partners, we have our colleague Donna wasn't here today, but I think she's the last minute issue come up. Palladium Partners is a consumer information firm. There's a lot of obviously everything in healthcare, actually. And then WebMD, Jane Lowers is here from WebMD Medscape. We also have a stakeholder council of 25 members that are represented from all different stakeholder groups, clinicians, health systems, and so on. I'm not going to read them all. They're here on the slide. And this stakeholder council has been really great. We've met once already to talk about design and vet design and talk about issues around other stakeholder groups that we may or may not touch, I mean, who we should touch in terms of this project, get feedback on the action plan at the end of the day. And you'll see that in a second and what I mean by that. So that's the team. So what have we been asked to do in terms of the action plan? We've been asked to put together a strategic plan to guide dissemination and implementation activities for PCORI-funded research. We see that the action plan has three basic core principles at the base level, being inclusiveness of stakeholder groups, multimodal engagement, and dissemination tactics, and informed and innovative approaches to dissemination implementation, meaning approaches that we know work really well are evidence-based and innovative ones, which we think have promise, but you know, maybe don't have a strong evidence base right now. Key components of the action plan itself will be, it'll be based on definitions of dissemination implementation that everyone, you know, well, most everyone can agree on, a multi-level dissemination implementation framework. And then we also will have in this plan identification of the needs of various stakeholder audiences, identification of tactics that work best for target audiences, partnership and engagement strategies, and recommendations for testing and evaluation D&I efforts, which we think is an important part of this plan, obviously. I'll talk in a little bit what we're envisioning kind of the format on of this plan as well, as we said, these early stages in the project, to give everyone a sense for what that all means in a little, you know, more concrete terms. So what are the goals of the action plan? Well, first off is to guide PCORI in dissemination of this fund of research, but remember it's D and I. So it's also to help speed the implementation of facilitating the use of research findings by healthcare decision makers. Also to assess the effectiveness of D&I efforts in reducing practice variation disparities. And then lastly, to address the dissemination and implementation needs of a diverse array of stakeholder groups. I wanted to show this slide real quick to everyone a sense for the timeline. Basically, there are two phases to our project. The first phase is action plan development, and the second phase is stakeholder feedback. So the key date here is sometime in mid-July. We'll have drafted the action plan. At that point, we move into taking the show on the road. And essentially, we'll be talking to many different people and many different stakeholder audiences that are of interest to PCORI, which I'm going to show you all in a second. So what we're working on now as a team is what we're just calling the action plan development phase. We started this only in early March, and we're still in it. What we've done is conduct a literature scan for research that gives us a sense for best practices and facilitators and barriers in dissemination implementation. We are soon to be conducting interviews with stakeholders. We've developed a topic guide that helps us guide the whole project, for example. And we're conducting something kind of new and innovative with a company called Code Digital. What we're doing there is actually receiving feedback via the internet. We're getting help from partner organizations with the quarry, some emails out to their constituents in physician audiences, nurse audiences, and consumer audiences. And so far, so good. We actually started data collection that on Friday. And my colleague Laura was working on that, tells me that so far, you know, we had some really nice data collected, and it's been a nice participation rate so far. As a part of the action plan development phase, after reviewing everything that we collect, we'll be conducting a gap analysis. As a part of this phase, we're also going to be producing some short case studies that will feed into the action plan itself. Case studies of kind of exemplar dissemination and implementation activities that can help kind of ground what we're writing in the case studies in the action plan. And then as part of the action, as part of this phase, we'll summarize everything in our landscape report before we produce the action plan itself. In the feedback phase, what we're doing is a number of different activities to collect information from a multitude of different stakeholder groups. So this is currently a list of the groups that we're going to reach out to. It's everything from patients, consumers, and caregivers to policymakers and researchers. So we're hoping, you know, we've worked with Orlando and Sue Hildebrand on this. We're hoping that we've hit the primary stakeholder audiences that are of interest to the quarry and that are going to have an interest in this action plan. So what's the process here? Essentially, we will draft the action plan. We'll then solicit stakeholder input on the action plan via webinars, focus groups, and interviews. We'll refine the action plan after receiving that feedback. And then we'll convene a workshop, tentatively for late October. It might be early November. We haven't settled on a date yet exactly. And then we'll finalize the action plan before the end of this year. So what have we been thinking in terms of format? Because right now all I've been saying is action plan, action plan, action plan. And you're probably thinking, that's great, but what does that mean? And, you know, oftentimes we have a nice thinking what that means too, to be quite frank, but don't tell Orlando that. Okay. So we've been thinking there's an external facing document that will be relatively brief, and there'll be an internal facing document primarily. There'll be an operational toolkit like approach to it where it has lots of examples and lots of tools, hopefully, that can be used internally by PCORI, but also by PCORI funded investigators as well as you're thinking about dissemination implementation. Really anyone who wants to use these tools. So in terms of this external facing document, it'll be based kind of in a strategic framework like approach where we'll ground the action plan itself in definitions of dissemination and implementation. Hopefully we have some working ones to share with you in a little bit. The plan itself will also include a step where we think about research usefulness and discuss kind of recommendations for how to do that assessment. PCORI, of course, being very interested in producing research that's not just unbiased and objective, but also useful to decision makers on the ground at the point of care. The plan will also then illuminate kind of engagement vehicles and approaches that can be used for different audiences, identify, you know, have a section on audience identification and segmentation, and then talk a bit about recommendations for measurement and evaluation of dissemination implementation efforts. The idea behind the operational toolkit is to provide tools for action plan users considering, you know, dissemination implementation of their research findings. Provide as many examples that we can uncover from the literature, provide information on where there are current gaps in the literature as in terms of what works best for which subpopulations, which decision makers, and at the point of care. And then also providing illustrative examples, and this is where we get back to the case studies of the dissemination implementation process. They're in the toolkit that we can weave both into the toolkit and also the external facing document. Wanted to talk a little bit about next steps. Our landscape review will be completed sometime in mid-June. Our draft action plan will be completed sometime in mid-July. Our goal here is to solicit stakeholder feedback starting in mid-July through the end of September. We'll refine the action plan, hold a workshop, October-November range. By the starting sometime, actually this process has started already, sorry, starting now. And so, again, the action plan is due. We're working on developing recommendations for evaluating and measuring DNI efforts, and then we'll be finalizing the action plan before the end of the year. So this slide says November 2014. Our contract ends in December, so it'll be sometime late December, late November, early December.
And I could just add to bring the interest of the group here is that when we go to solicit stakeholder feedback, we'll link the deliberate effort to all members of the advisory panel to be able to participate in that. So we'll send you information where you can read the plan and take that period of time to be able to provide the input. And then secondly, we'll definitely send out those invitations for the stakeholder workshop in October to you as well. So those are two moments of the process in which you will be able to provide input as well.
Great. Thanks, Orlando. Getting to further input on the next slide. So as Orlando mentioned, you'll have opportunity before the next time you meet in late September, early October, to comment on the action plan. And at some point, the team will also put together a webinar for people interested, people on panels who are interested in participating and providing your feedback in that way. At any time, Jennifer and I are happy to take your emails, suggestions, or thoughts, or take a call with you if you'd like to discuss anything you'd like to discuss on this. You know, anyone who has an opinion or has something to say and would like to provide some feedback, we're happy to take it. You know, we really like to have this be as stakeholder-driven as possible. But recognizing that, you know, as a team, we're really, really strong, but no one of us is a specific expert in anything. So we'd like to hear what you have to say as well. So in terms of the breakout groups,
when you said that, I saw something back there that said action plan users and tools for action plan users. Who are the responsible, who's responsible for implementing the action plan?
Well, I think at the end of the day, you know, the action plan is for PCORI-funded researchers. You know, I don't know that there is one responsible party necessarily, but the goal here is to create a plan that is specific to PCORI funded research, first off, and the type of research that we're going to be doing at PCORI in terms of stakeholder-driven research and research that's useful at the point of care at the end of the day, providing information that can be used to help make a healthcare decision. That being said, it also has to you also have to recognize in the action plan that, you know, research that's done, even by PCORI, is done in, you know, not in a vacuum. There's other research out there, too, so it has to be, you know, constantly synthesizing evidence going forward as well. So, you know, who's going to be responsible at the end of the day? I think it'll be a partnership, as a lot of PCORI research is, between investigators who have conducted research and the community who's working on the research as well in PCORI.
Okay, I guess that's not what I meant. What I meant is, are the researchers going to be responsible for seeing to it that the results are implemented and then they evaluate them? Or is it going to be the staff who are, or an evaluation group that is going to be responsible for evaluating implementation?
So this isn't intended to be who's going to do what. This is a framework that's going to identify what activities are best positioned to help disseminate and implement PCORI findings. And then that will be the job of PCORI and the board to determine the responsible parties. And obviously this will be shared with everyone. So there are other agencies and funding groups and community groups that will find this useful as they approach how to get information into the hands of people who need it.
Thanks, Jean. So in terms of the breakout groups, we thought this would be a great opportunity to get your thoughts on kind of the discussion questions we prepared. And I think we have a handout of all the different groups that we've set this up with PCORI's help. Why don't you kind of set the stage with working definitions of dissemination implementation in terms of thinking about what we'd like to discuss in the dissemination breakout groups versus what we'd like to discuss in implementation groups. And essentially, dissemination, you know, as we have defined here,
refers to really increasing awareness or helping something happen, as opposed to implementation, which refers to overcoming barriers to achieve the use of certain information or making something happen. In some circles, the distinction is lines are blurred. There's dissemination can't happen without implementation happening afterwards and vice versa. And so we're happy to really talk about both of the breakout groups. We'd like to focus two on dissemination and two on implementation because that's how we've set this up for today. Here's just a list of our discussion questions, and our group leaders have these lists as well. I'm pretty sure these questions were left to you as a handout as well. If not, we have them. Essentially, what we're looking for here are best practices in dissemination or implementation. What facilitates dissemination? What are the challenges to successful dissemination? And how disseminators can effectively identify and take into account the needs of various audiences. So we're looking for best practices, facilitators and challenges, and then how to take into account the needs of various audiences when you're thinking about dissemination or implementation, for example. So what we'd like to do now is actually break up the group into four, and the leaders will lead them out. So we're going to just start with Allison's group. Allison, Ryan here. So we're kind of going to be working with group one. So if you are Paul Ross, Arthur, Kirsten Carmen, Perry Cohen, Lorraine Johnson, Sal Weingart, Dorian Miller, Russell Rossman, Tammy Burns, Chen Chi, and for Deborah Stewart, could you please follow Allison out into the main area? No, you're going to be in room one. You're already broken up. Oh, you're tired. Sorry. That's why. Sorry. It's been a long cruise. All right, so group two will be with Sarah Farstall. And so with Sarah is Amy Gibson, Melanie, Laurel, Sarah, Alfie Martina, Mary Sander, Kevin, and Martin. Please go with Sarah. Sarah Van. Group three was going with Jessica Haringa. So if you're Steve Blum, Bruce, Julie, Sally, Darius, Grant, Alan, Alina, Jacqueline, or Monique, please go Jessica. That's right. We're making it happen. All right, and then with me is Mark, Charlotte, Regina, Deanna, Liz, Patrick, Carmen, Etche, and Dina.
Okay, thank you for joining us. For some reason, we thought Dominique was coming back, and we were waiting for him to realize she's not coming back, so we will proceed with the discussion on the rubric. So, this morning you heard Joe reference the patient and family engagement rubric, and I must applaud all the patient engagement advisory panel members that really committed to spending a lot of time helping develop this. And I also want to recognize Suzanne Trant, who is our deputy director in patient engagement, who right now is in Argentina. And I surveyed her from calling in. She's very sorry that she missed this. And Suzanne, if you're on the phone, you can hang up right now. But she also was a huge contributor to the creation of this rubric. And this rubric really was a response to considering PCORI talks about, doing research differently. And that really is what makes us unique, is the engagement that is embedded in the research that we find, and also the engagement that we embed in how we operate as an organization, and that's embedded in our culture. But as we call for engagement in the research that we fund, the number one question that we got was, what is engagement in research? Specifically, what is patient engagement in research? Because that really is the newcomer. That's the new territory. So we really were charged with what really started this idea of the rubric off was that our executive director, Joe, asked engagement if we would find what we thought were good engagement plans in proposals that were submitted to PCORI. So we embarked on a journey of carrying around 150 applications and reading through the engagement plans, and we really found that there were some common themes, and there were some really interesting tidbits where we thought people were patients and caregivers and others were participating in different areas of the research process. So as we started coding these engagement plans, we really saw that we could potentially create a tool to help not only the researchers who are asking what is engagement in research, but we are also receiving questions from patients and patient organizations saying, we want to participate in PCORI, how do we do it? So we saw the creation of this tool for a variety of stakeholders. And so we thought that we could really bring the patient engagement advisory panel that we call the PEEP, by the way, we could really bring the PEEP into the fold. And so they rolled up their sleeves and they read for us engagement plans and scored them based on a draft rubric that we created. And so we went through several iterations. So you can see up here why I developed the rubric. Well, it was in response to the research and the patient community asking what does engagement in research look like. The rubric is actually a framework. You know, it's a framework for, and we're giving options and examples of what engagement in research looks like. And then how will it be used? It's not only used for the applicants and the patient stakeholder partners, but this, we're also carrying this, we're operationalizing the rubrics throughout all of PCORI in that the merit reviewers, now for those of you who have been merit reviewers, we know that in the past a lot of reviewers have said they had to read through pages and pages and pages of the proposal to really pluck out where the engagement was. And so we wanted to put this in one concise place in the proposal and so that merit reviewers could use this rubric to really see, is this meaningful engagement in our research? And then also we are using this for training for our awardees and as well as our program officers, and we've also created a new position at PCORI called the engagement officer. I'm going to talk a little more about that. So we want to make sure not only are we creating a rubric to help people understand what is meaningful engagement in research. We want to see that research go on throughout the lifetime of the project, not just so that we get a great research proposal that looks good on paper, but what they say they are going to do on paper is actually what they do in their research process. So here's the process that we went through, just to recap, that the PEEP provided recommendations to PCORI on the engagement rubric. And then we took it back to PCORI, and our own staff and engagement used the rubric to really evaluate several engagement plans. So we refined it, and then we passed it on to our science directors, and they also had a chance to look at it and refine it. And I think that was at the last meeting that we all had. Joe Selby sat down and read through the whole thing, and then he made a few tweaks to it. And then we finally did embed it in our first funding announcement. In we launched it in a funding announcement in February of this year. So our currently, right now, we have researchers who are using the rubric. They're applying for our funding right now. We're entertaining all kinds of questions about the rubric. But we took the rubric and we really built it with the PEEP around four separate elements. One is planning the study, one is conducting the study, one is disseminating the study, and we wanted to ensure that the PCORI engagement principles were embedded all along the way, those being honesty, respect, transparency, partnership, co-learning, and reciprocal relationships. We want to see kind of that soul in this research as well. And what we did is, you know, looking at all of the questions that we're getting from researchers and patients about what is patient engagement in research, we've created a new webpage called Engagement in Research,
where the rubric is on this webpage. There's, you see Lena, who's on our peak right now. She was interviewed. She's also done a blog. We have other webinar series that highlighted what does engagement look like in the research that CORE is funding. So this is a great page as a resource for all that has to do with engagement in research. And we're creating a compendium of links to find other literature on it. But we think this will become a really nice go-to place for researchers and patients and patient organizations who really want to get more involved in research. This is just an example of, in our PFA, a PCORI funding announcement, that we created an actual rubric template. So the applicants actually fill out a template that follows the exact order of the rubric. And actually, you have the rubric. It's in your package, and it took me a while to find it. On the back of the driver model, I think these got stapled together. The rubric is back here. So it walks through all those various elements and gives really concrete examples of what does it look like when patients get engaged in developing a research question and picking the comparators and creating surveys and delivering and moderating focus groups where we're really seeing the patient communities really involved in this. And so the rubric we turned into a blank template, and so now applicants fill out this template that follows the rubric. So we're getting a lot of feedback right now sharing with us that it's really helping them identify where they had holes in their engagement plans, and they're able to follow the rubric to help fill in those gaps. So what we've done with this rubric is we've had a whole series of town hall meetings for both our broad and targeted PFA. So when CORE makes an announcement, the rubric's embedded in the announcement. Typically our program, our science areas, host a town hall where we do Q&A, and so we've been entertaining all the questions on the rubric. There's a wonderful page on our website that's in the funding center under, I think it's Q&As. You'll find there's a whole section now on engagement, so whenever we get a question, either via phone or through these town halls, we answer it and we post it. So now we can send people to the Q&As, and to date, all of our questions have been from researchers and applicants. However, just this last week, we've been having a lot of discussions. We've been getting a lot of questions from patients and patient organizations saying, I'm now receiving several requests to submit letters of support that researchers want from the patients and patient organizations. And so I think I'm going to start posting their questions as well, because what we're encouraging, both Charlotte and I have been discussing this as others, that we really think this rubric can become a tool that when researchers invite patients to submit letters of support, they can do that, but also say, here is what the expectations are from CORE when it comes to engagement. Not only do I want to provide a letter of support, I want to be engaged in your research process. So in effect, it's giving them a tool to negotiate and to help the researchers and applicants understand that they're a partnership in state place. And here it spells out what they can all do together. So I think we're going to start a Q&A for patient and patient organizations as well. We're doing presentations to key stakeholders already. We've been invited by the GIA. And before we did a webinar together, I presented the rubric at IOM Roundtable and just recently at the National Institute of Mental Health. Well, actually, I looked at all of our mental health portfolio, and I made a rubric just based on mental health. So all of the examples were based on all of our mental health portfolio. We could do this with disparities. We could do this with a variety of different, through a variety of different lenses now that we have a large portfolio. We are, as I mentioned, this is being incorporated into the merit review training and process. The next review will have this the rubric embedded in it. We have trained ambassadors in this program, our PFA applicants and awardees, and we're now training our pipeline proposals, which you don't know about yet, but you will next time. But we're just really trying to get our whole organization kind of wrapped around this rubric to really drive this new part of research that CORE is really engaged in. So this concept that I brought up at the beginning of engagement officers, you know, it's wonderful, like I said, to have expectations and get wonderful research proposals in writing, go through a merit review and choose, and then when we're writing the contract with the applicants, our engagement officers, the new positions of which we have, is Kim in the room? Kim's not in the room, but we have JD's in the room, raise your hand. She's going to be working with PCORNET in this area.
But they work, the engagement officers will be working really closely, I mean, hand-in-hand with the science program officers, and engagement officers will be helping create engagement milestones. And so they'll be a great resource, the PI and their patient partner. Every 6 months, the engagement officer with the program officer will be reviewing, are they meeting their engagement milestones, and if not, can we be a resource to help them? We can help troubleshoot, we can course correct. We, every 6 months, will be speaking directly with, we'll be having an interview with their primary patient partner, independently from the PI, just to make sure that they feel like they're being heard, that they're contributing, that the engagement is indeed meaningful and real. And so we think that this is going to really just kind of be an engagement assurance level that, again, as Corey talked about doing research differently, we have to make sure that we indeed are doing research differently. And as we embed these new engagement officers, they're going to be extracting promising practices and reading all of the new proposals that come in. I'm happy to pass that off. It was fascinating to read about our portfolio. And then we'll be updating. I think Darius mentioned Rubric 2.0 or whatever you said. I think we're going to have various versions, and what we hope to create is some enthusiasm and anticipation that when we're going to launch the next version of the rubric, that it will have new, maybe even more innovative, more creative examples. And so what we're doing is we're really inviting the community, kind of in a wiki style, inviting the community to create the next version. And so this is really a framework for innovation. And we really want to see creative engagement coming in from, you know, on these applications. And quite honestly, I think that, and we're already seeing that, a lot of patients are actually already reaching out to researchers. Instead of this being research-driven, we're already seeing applications come in that are actually have been patient-driven, finding their researcher. We have patients that have gone to researchers with the rubric and saying, this is what we can offer. We have our, we've got our solution. We've got our research question. Join us.
So I think this is wonderful. So this morning during the Addressing Disparities Advisory Panel meeting, I think, Deborah, you brought it up first, was, and a couple of our advisory panel members actually specifically asked about, you know, some products or information that we could begin to get out into the world about what we're doing that's innovative around engagement. And so I think this is a really great opportunity to really think about, you know, what those materials would be, that there's a real hunger out there in the world for this kind of information. It's new. And part of this is also, you know, as we're funding the science and waiting for the data and the results that are a little bit more long-term in terms of coming in and our ability to talk about the output, this is a real opportunity to show some real proximal output and would be a new contribution. So I would, I guess a part of my ask here is, has the P with the engagement team started to think about, you know, what kind of materials or products for dissemination can we start developing to get out in terms of what Corey's doing in this area?
Well, we have the actual rubric itself. You know, that's something we just have. We have links and that to that. We also we're in the process of creating some publications, and so we can disseminate once we finally do the publications. We can disseminate that. We're also looking at venues and to speak at annual conferences, and so that's another that we might even have some spokespeople present on the rubric because they are part of the creation of it. So I would love to creatively think about, you know, what's the best way to present this and to what audience. I think we're going to have different kinds of products, and we have a rubric training deck that we've created that will be available to ambassadors and the PEEP and others who want to present this to their communities. And we haven't created it yet. We're going to do kind of audio with a slide presentation so people can just watch it online as well. So next steps. I think we just kind of talked about next steps. Just looking for opportunities to present to publications. We'd like to get feedback. We're going to, this round with the applicants and our merit reviewers, we're going to create a survey and get feedback from them to see, did this make it easier to apply? Was it easier to review? Was it more meaningful? And if we want to readjust,
We're looking at the possibility of creating a similar tool for non-patient stakeholders. You know, we just focus this on patients and caregivers and family members, but we understand that we encourage engagement from the other stakeholders as well. And so we're thinking about how do we either create that tool or ensure that we're getting that meaningful engagement as well. We're going to revise and expand the rubric on an ongoing basis, and then we're going to evaluate. And so we've invited our evaluation team to work with us very closely with both the rubric and the engagement officer to determine what does success look like, and let's measure that, and let's course correct if we get on course. And then evaluation will be a very big piece of what we do as we follow this. And that is the presentation of the rubric, and I invite any questions or comments, but we feel it's going to be a cornerstone of what CORI does going forward, and I look forward to the next iteration of it because I think it's going to be even more innovative.
Thanks, I'm sorry to run about 5 minutes to get there, but how do you explain who a stakeholder is to the reviewers? Because as someone who's actually been through several CORI reviews, I find some are a lot more expansive of who they think I should have as a stakeholder versus others, and it's to a point that I feel like it would be really unrealistic to include everyone that they believe is a stakeholder, because then I don't get the core. If I really expand it to a really broad network, then I'm really not getting meaningful stakeholder involvement than those closest to the problem. So can you comment on that?
Regina. So the rubric is great. I've been studying it with our patient engagement clusters. They see it as part of a great opportunity to engage, or the opportunity knowing that they can engage with our researchers and in the levels of participation that they can. Observation. Are we planning on having presentations and meetings in the, I'll call it, in non-traditional areas other than at and hotels or other places that we can really get to the community level, especially for the rubric to get it into the community? Is that a consideration that we might be able to look at, finding community partners who are ready to be involved with research to come to them on that level?
Absolutely, and I think that's probably something our ambassadors will be doing. I think that this is going to be a great tool for the ambassadors to share with their communities what does patient community engagement really look like? And I think that's going to be perfect for the community level and for our ambassadors. And as the CORI does workshops out in the field, we'd also bring this up, you know, as we do it in Minneapolis and other areas. We'll definitely bring this up. But this is not just for Washington, D.C. This is definitely for, you know, it's really a tool when patient groups really say we want to get involved in CORI, we don't really know how. I mean, this gives them really nice concrete examples that could be at the community level or at a very high patient organization level.
So I think this is fantastic, and my hope would be that part of the evaluation, that the effectiveness that you're examining is not just the effectiveness of the dissemination of this information, but the effectiveness of researchers who partner in actually doing this once they get the money. So that it's not window dressing to get the money and then it just disappears, which, you know, often happens. We sort of, you know, I'm a researcher, we figure out sort of what's the best way to sell it. We sell it and get the money and do whatever we want to do.
No, and actually that was a big part of the genesis of this rubric, because the PEEP actually, on their very first meeting, mentioned that they wanted their legacy to be that they assured that the engagement in PCORI's research was meaningful and enduring. And so that really was the genesis of how we structured not just the rubric, but the operationalization of the rubric and our engagement officer, that there are check-ins. And remember, we have contracts. And so if they're not meeting their engagement milestones or their scientific milestones, they're going to have to make some adjustments for that contract to continue. And so we're very aware of, I think a lot of us in this room have been patients, token patients. And so we want to make sure that PCORI doesn't experience that. And actually in our monitoring report, it's interesting to look at. We also, our evaluation tool that I'm sorry we're not presenting to you now and maybe we can next time, but it really is it's a very thorough evaluation tool that they ask you, both the PI and the patient partner, about the levels of engagement, what are the barriers, what are the pluses and minuses. It really is digging it down into the partnership and the reality of the engagement. So I think we're going to have a lot from this evaluation tool. I think we're going to have a lot to share and a lot of learning, not just for PCORI, but other research agencies as well.
Amy, you had a question?
Oh.
Paul, you changed your mind?
Great. Well, that is, what do we have after this?
I'm sorry, Jay, I didn't hear. Don't we get to hear about what the implementation and dissemination group?
I understand that's going to be done all via email. Is that correct? That's going to be done all follow-up afterwards. Well, I just want to, I think this is, just so you know, you are the very first two panels to ever integrate, so I think we deserve great credit for that. And actually, I think it's been really productive, and I think, you know, Ramon and I have been talking about, we're seeing lots of opportunities in cross-fertilization, so if you have any ideas about kind of the next time we're together, if there's other panels that you'd like to collaborate with. I think this is maybe we're setting a new model. I don't know. But I see lots of opportunities, and I really appreciate you being open to us working together. I'm not going to recap today because we know what happened today. And so I would invite the chairs, if chairs and co-chairs, if you have any comments to.
Well, let me just first say that I've enjoyed this. My colleague, Dr. Miller, had to leave because she's involved in planning and being involved in a conference in Chicago, and she had to be back for that. But we have lots of things in common in that we have co-chair positions in common, and some of the other committees are singularly chaired. We have some goals and objectives that are that have some common challenges to them. And I hope that we could do this again in the future, so I've enjoyed it very much. So thank you.
I would have to concur. I hope we can do it again. It has been enjoyable, and it's been enjoyable having a chance to interact with, met so many of you one-on-one. We've kind of passed like ships in the night before, and this has really been good.
I'd just like to say, I know we're at the end of a very long day, and people may have comments about the engagement rubric, and you know, there are a couple questions about how it's going to be used, how it's going to be monitored. I think that those are really important, and I think that they validate a lot of the things that we've been trying to work through as a PEEP. I would just say, yeah, please let us know if there are other things that you see as strengths that we can enhance, limitations that maybe need to be revised for the 2.0, because I think that this is something that's getting a lot of traction, and for it to really have the impact that we want, you know, it's not just the PEEP, it's everybody who's part of these panels who can really help to shape it.
I was just going to make a comment about the two groups coming together, and I think it was great that we had the two groups. This big room like this, I think, is difficult to get a lot of input and feedback because, you know, I could barely see across the other side of the table. There was a lot of energy at those small tables during the breakout sessions. So I would certainly encourage, if we're going to meet in the future, look for opportunities like that where you can have, you know, really more in-depth discussions and deliberations. And if we do that, hopefully we can find a place where there isn't so much crosstalk and chatter that makes it difficult for those teams to hear one another. But I thought it was great and really enjoyed that part. I think there was a lot of energy and enthusiasm there.